Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It's easy for me to talk to anybody, any place in this country, and say, we were founded by the Ball family, and say, of the Ball Jar, because so far I've never met anybody who doesn't know what a Ball Jar is.
Karen Vincent is the director of collections for Miniaturistic Cultural Center in Muncie, Indiana. She tells Traditional Arts Indiana the history of the canning behemoth, the Ball Corporation. We get Food Preservation 101 from canning guru and author Sandor Katz. In the kitchen, fresh watermelon and blackberries are transformed into refreshing summer drinks. And it's back to school time, so Harvest Public Media talks school gardens. Stay with us. To find out what happened in food news, we turn to Luann Johnson.
As Indiana University students returned to class this week, the university rolled out a pilot program that it hopes will convert food waste from campus cafeterias into compost, instead of tossing the scraps into local landfills. The Indiana University Office of Sustainability is partnering with the local Growers Guild and the Indiana Department of Environmental Management to allow local farmers and community organizations to collect pre-consumer food waste from campus dining facilities for off-campus composting. IU's Hilltop Garden and Nature Center is currently composting food waste from two dining facilities. The garden amendment is then used to grow fresh produce served in campus cafeterias. A new study of about 3,000 kids showed a strong link between aggressive or violent behavior and how much soda kids drink each day. 5-year-olds who drank 4 or more sodas a day were more than twice as likely to destroy property or even attack other people. 43% of the children in the survey drank at least one serving of soda a day. 4% drank 4 sodas daily. The study, published in the Journal of Pediatrics, is the first to examine the link between soda and behavior in children. Dr. Shakira Sulia is the author of the study. She said, quote, "We're just adding one more study to what's already out there that says these little ones shouldn't be drinking soda." To be fair, the research showed a strong correlation, but didn't try to prove a cause and effect relationship between soda and mean kids. Proving that a particular ingredient causes a particular behavior is tricky and would require completely different methods than the ones used in this study. They used an existing national survey of mothers and children to collect the study's data. Sales of organic food in the U.S. have increased 13% over the past year alone, and big food vendors are vying for a share of the increased demand. Take two organic markets, Whole Foods and Sprouts Farmers Market. Sprouts is a southwestern chain that is steadily encroaching on Whole Foods turf, expanding across the southeast. Kroger has also announced it will cut prices on organics to entice customers. While all this competition may have company execs sweating, it's good news for consumers who are seeing prices fall. And the Natural Resources Defense Council is suggesting the federal government could have avoided paying out more than $1 billion to cover crop losses in Indiana after last year's devastating drought. The federal crop insurance program paid Hoosier farmers more than $1.1 billion to cover 2012's crop losses. The report suggests some of the losses could have been prevented if farmers used practices that promote soil health, such as no-till farming, which allows underground life that benefits soil to go undisturbed. Cover crops are grown in the off-season chiefly for soil health. Others claim that while practices like cover crops and no-till do promote greater soil health, their increased use would likely have made little difference to Indiana farmers during last year's drought. Read more about these stories on our website, eartheats.org.
We post news stories like these throughout the week on our Twitter feed and Facebook page. Join the conversation. Search for Earth Eats. Luann Johnson, thanks for the news.
See you next week.
School gardens offer educators a chance to teach students about math and science through the hands-on experience of growing fruits and vegetables. But as these educational projects grow in popularity, they present unique challenges to teachers and communities, particularly in the summer. Harvest Public Media's Payne Roberts visits Lawrence, Kansas to find out more.
In Lawrence, Kansas, asparagus is a hot commodity.
The demand for asparagus was just
was and it continues to be very, very strong.
That's John Pendleton. Adorned in a matching green hat and apron, he's selling homegrown produce at the Clinton Parkway Nursery Farmers Market in Lawrence. Pendleton's Country Market is a staple at area farmers markets and has been selling locally grown food for more than 30 years.
Thanks for coming out today.
Several stands down, the competition. Three middle school students are selling potatoes, cucumbers, and an array of herbs that were all grown in their school garden. Perry Kennard, a seventh grade science teacher at Southwest Junior High in Lawrence, oversees this garden. It's their second summer in the market, but this year they tried something new, asparagus.
We're hoping to expand the variety that we can offer and the experience that we have for our kids and for our community.
So is there an asparagus war boiling in Kansas? Pendleton says no. The school gardens won't really harm his business, but he has felt an impact.
A particular restaurant might not be taking that much stuff, but if you take three or four restaurants and pool it together, then it makes it worthwhile to make a delivery. And if all of a sudden they're buying from the kids because it's the politically correct thing to do, you know, that we maybe have lost a market that way.
Unexpected competition is one challenge communities must face when it comes to school gardens. The number of these projects in the U.S. has exploded in popularity over the past decade. That's according to the National Farm to School Network. These programs typically operate by student and volunteer labor with funding from donations and grants. Most often, the produce is used in school cafeterias, but because the growing season doesn't coincide with the school year, the question of how to most effectively use school gardens in the summertime is often a concern. Here's Pendleton again.
They start off with saying, yeah, we can run it through the school kitchens and things like that, but when you realize that the majority of the produce that they raise isn't during the school year.
To curb the amount of produce sold at the farmer's market, Southwest Junior High offers a CSA program for parents and faculty, and it donates some food to the school cafeteria. However, because the growing season peaks during the summertime, less than 10% of that food is served at the school. Summertime also causes difficulty when it comes to enlisting labor assistants, leaving the work to volunteers and teachers.
One of the advantages of being a teacher is that you have your summers off. Well, I don't have my summers off anymore.
And that burden isn't reduced once the school year returns, as teachers then must cultivate their gardens and their students.
Listen, it's very easy to get into this well-intended but not understand the amount of labor involved.
That's Stephen Ritz, a teacher and administrator from the South Bronx who advocates nationwide for school gardens. He recently came to Lawrence to offer advice for community members who are interested in sustaining its school gardens. Ritz said school gardens are more successful today because educators tie them to academics, as compared to the traditional model, where gardens were used as an excuse to move classes outdoors in pleasant weather.
Now we're talking about percent germination. We're talking about reading. We're talking about writing. We're talking about documenting the process. We're talking about math. We're talking about making connections. We're talking about the whole process, as opposed to just being out there and digging in the dirt.
The National Farm to School Network expects the number of school gardens to increase. For now, there appears to be plenty of room for them at farmers markets as the market for locally grown food increases. But as any gardener can attest, overcrowding can stunt growth. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Payne Roberts.
Read and listen to more stories from the entire reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. Tis the season for food preservation. Cucumbers become pickles, tomatoes turn into sauce, watermelon rinds are candied. Josephine McRobbie of Traditional Arts Indiana explores the one thing that makes canning, pickling, and other methods of food preservation possible, the container. She speaks with Karen Vincent, Director of Collections for the Minnetristic Cultural Center in Muncie, Indiana, to learn about the history of the Ball Corporation.
Muncie, in East Central Indiana, is deeply associated with the legacy of the Ball family, for whom Ball State University is named. The five Ball brothers founded the Ball Corporation in the late 1800s.
The Ball family is originally moved to Muncie from Buffalo, New York. They started a manufacturing company in Buffalo in about 1880, they really did not intend originally to move from Buffalo, but just simply to build a branch factory. They came to the Midwest because of the natural gas boom in the late 1800s and visited several cities, came to Muncie, and the brothers were offered a very sweet deal by the leading businessmen in Muncie. By the late 1890s, they were all here, built their homes along the boulevard, and lived the rest of their lives all next door to each other.
Though the Ball Corporation is no longer centered in Muncie, it was a giant in the community and economy for over 100 years. Now it's a large part of local heritage, centered at the Minnetrista Cultural Center. Karen Vinson is the director of collections for Minnetrista, a museum home to a large archive of items of importance to the area, a number of which are food-related.
Muncie and Delaware County and the surrounding counties and the early late part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century were very much manufacturers of household products. So besides jars, and not just Ball, but a number of others, stoves, the Hoosier-style cabinets made in Elwood and Newcastle, Muncie pottery, Ontario manufacturing in Muncie made silverware.
Among other items, Karen supervises 700 or 800 Ball jars and other jars made in the area, some of which are from companies Ball bought out.
It's easy for me to talk to anybody, any place in this country, and say, we were founded by the Ball family, and say, of the Ball jar, because so far I've never met anybody who doesn't know what a Ball jar is, even if they've never canned.
Karen agreed to show me around the archives.
You know, I come from a long line of women who don't can, but for me it's the stories that go behind the jar that I think are the really interesting part. Several siblings that probably in the 1930s buried their pet canary in a ball jar. And when they got back together one time at the family home when they were adults, sometime in the early 50s, they decided to dig it up, see if it was still there. So they dug it up. You could still see the canary, feathers and all. Well, they contacted George Ball and asked him if he'd be interested in having it, and he said yes. So they sent it to him, and we now have it.
Most of the items in the collection wouldn't go for much money on eBay or at auction. An exception are jars that have been modified to perform some new task.
This might have been a sugar dispenser. We have attachments that you would use as chicken feeders. I've seen them attached to oil cans. There's a historical society near here that has an iron lung from the TB epidemic that there's a ball jar on it that is actually part of the mechanism.
It's clear from this that Ball's legacy in Muncie lives on. Minnetrista also facilitates food preservation in their community through educational workshops, where groups learn the history of home canning, practice the hot water method, and take home a jar of their finished product. I stopped by a pre-workshop cook session at Minnetrista, where educational staff were working on a test run of a champagne blush jelly.
It's a fairly easy recipe as far as ingredients go. It's sugar, champagne, and
raspberry juice.
Educator Ashley Lichtenbarger and visitor services manager Tanya Brock ran me through the game plan.
We just combined the two juices. There's lemon juice and raspberry juice. And then you have to let that boil with the pectin, which is the gelling agent. And then you need to let it boil, and then you add in the sugar. And then you bring it to a boil and let it boil for about a minute, probably a little bit longer in this case. And then after that, then you add in your champagne, and then you put it in a processing water bath, which is the thing that makes it, preserves it, can, so that it seals the jars and all of that, and gets all the bacteria out and all that good stuff.
The champagne blush jelly might seem like an unusual choice, but it was picked for a reason.
In our canning workshops, we are trying to get people educated on a variety of levels. So whether that's the novice who's never even seen anyone can, learning the basics, or the person who's been canning for 70 years, getting them all at the same playing field of these are the modern scientific guidelines behind canning. And then we sprinkle in the history and the art. We try to highlight modern recipes, for example, like the champagne blush jelly, obviously a more modern recipe than minced meat, for example. So that is in response to trying to keep what we're doing very relevant, but with a nice nod to the traditional canning method.
Tanya, who's from Plainfield, Indiana, has been running canning workshops on and off since 1999 and has canned her whole life with periods of inactivity.
I can remember making grape jelly with Mom, and it was just part of what she did. And then when I started here, I don't know, 13 years ago, and I can remember my very first day calling my mom going, oh my goodness, I'm working for a place that has ball jars on display. Like, it was just everyday items, and I thought, really? As romantic as it sounds to say that I've been canning my whole life, obviously I wasn't cognizant of what I was doing. It was just, yeah, something that you did. But then bringing all that to fruition, working here, and realizing that, yeah, this actually is a way that people have been surviving over time and providing for themselves.
Traditional Arts Indiana explores Hoosier food traditions through their series Second Servings. Find more interviews at traditionalartsindiana.org. Coming up...
Recipe, I was out the other day. My brother was up from Texas, and we decided we were going to revert to our childhoods and go out and look for blackberries.
These little berries are a little too tart for yogurt or cereal, but they'll make a delicious blackberry cordial. But a little heads up on this, patience is key for this recipe. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Every week we speak with authors who have written everything from cookbooks to food history books, and we feature snippets of those interviews here on the program. Our book today is The Art of Fermentation by Sandor Katz. Chances are, he says, most of us started off our day with a product of fermentation, whether it was bread, coffee, or cheese. But it's not just the everyday foodstuffs.
If you walk into a gourmet food store and look around and think about the nature of the foods that you see there, almost all of the foods that we elevate to that gourmet status are products of fermentation.
Thanks to the revival of fermentation, he says more and more people are forsaking the high-end food stores and making their fermented foods themselves. It's easy, he promises. Here's 1 minute with Sandor Katz. We'll call this Fermentation 101.
The realm of fermentation that I think makes the most sense for most people who are wanting to explore this for the first time is fermenting vegetables. It's incredibly simple. All you do is take some vegetables, chop them up, shred them, create some surface area, salt them lightly to taste, spend a few minutes in a big bowl with your hands just squeezing them, bruising the vegetables, and they'll start to get really wet. Once the vegetables are nice and wet, then you stuff them into a jar. Press really hard, get the vegetables pressed down so that they're submerged under their own juices. Then ferment them for a few days or a few weeks. It's really an incredibly versatile process. It is intrinsically safe. There is no safer food. There has never been a case of food poisoning reported in the United States from fermented vegetables. There are very few foods that you could say that about. You don't need any special equipment. You don't need a lot of background. I have just given, your listeners, as much information as they need to get started. Okay, well, thank you so much. Great to talk.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Read the complete interview with Sandor Katz, where he talks about a ferment of black-eyed peas he's especially fond of these days. It's called Akaraje. It's on our website, eartheats.org. A nice cold glass of fresh squeezed juice is sometimes all you need to turn the temperature down on a hot summer day. At Farm Bloomington, there's one guy working hard behind the bar to make sure there's plenty of lemonade to go around.
Okay, my name is Ali, A-L-I, Sohrabi, S-O-H-R-A-B-I. I'm from Iran. We have a fresh lemonade every Friday and Saturday, Sunday we made it here. Means it's fresh lemon with, again, local honey and a little bit of sugar. Just a little bit, we add it. In my country, we usually don't use a lot of sugar. Substitute is honey, and people love it.
He grew up on fresh juices in Iran. One of his favorites uses melon.
At least 1,000 years ago is the start. It's the same drink every year during the summer, made from cantaloupe, fresh cantaloupe, and homemade honey. It's really popular in my country. During the summer, you can drink just as a regular drink in the cooler, or you can freeze it and like the ice cream or sorbet during the summer.
Toss some chopped pistachios on top of that cantaloupe sorbet, and that's a dessert Chef Daniel Orr can get behind. In this first recipe, he's inspired by the simplicity of that Persian drink, but he has a different melon on the cutting board.
So today we're using a little local watermelon, and what I'm going to do is I cut off the top and the bottom, and that way it sits stable, and then I'm going to take the peel off of it. And you just kind of follow the line. You follow right along that melon rind. And you can use the melon rind for pickling. A lot of people don't know that. But back in the day when they didn't have a whole lot to eat during the war and between the wars, World War I, World War II, people made do with what they had. And watermelon rinds were a favorite to have alongside cold cuts and smoked fresh local ham and that kind of thing. And what you'd do is take the rind, take the peel off of it, so you're just using the white part, and then pickle it with some sugar and spices, and then you could store it, you could can it.
Yeah, so it's a sweet preparation.
Right, exactly. So now you have your nude watermelon, and what a lot of people don't know is that the seeds do grow in a circle. So if you cut that in half, you can see there's a nice center part that has no seeds. So go ahead and cut that out in a circle. And then you can just take your knife and get rid of all the little seeds. Okay, we're going to throw these nice chunks into the blender.
I have to say, this is part of why I don't really enjoy watermelon so much, because dealing with the seeds is so tedious.
Right, but you can see if you know where the seeds are, it's not that difficult. And I think that the watermelons with seeds actually taste a lot better than the seedless varieties. And I know a lot of people love the simplicity and ease of the seedless varieties, but they just aren't quite as sweet. All right, so we've got these nice and seeded, and we're going to puree this. And if you want to, you could add a little bit of water to get the engine going. So we'll just put a little splash in here. And we're going to whiz it around. Easy as that. Now what we're going to do, just to make it a little more fun, is put some fresh herbs in it. So we're going to use some mint. Chiffonade, which means that we're going to cut it into thin little ribbons. Okay, and then I've got some frozen glasses. What we're going to do is put the mint leaves in first. So when we pour the melon puree over the top, it will mix in. And that's all there is to it.
Let's give it a taste, you and me, Chef. Cheers.
Cheers. Here's to Earth Eats.
Mmm. Yummy.
Isn't that fresh? Perfect cure for a hot day.
Staying behind the bar, he's made a couple flavored liqueurs this season, one with black currants and another with blackberries. That blackberry liqueur turned out so well,
that Chef Orr's going to do it again today.
Recipe, I was out the other day. My brother was up from Texas, and we decided we were going to revert to our childhoods and go out and look for blackberries that grow on Powerline Hill, where we used to go as kids and ride our bikes down this big hill, and there's always great blackberries. And about 3 years ago, they went through and they cleared everything out, so all this is new growth, perfect time for blackberries because blackberries go great on new growth. So we're going to make a cordial out of them. All right? So a cordial is basically a sweet alcoholic drink. And I've got a beautiful little decanter here, and that makes it very showy. So you could make this, keep it out on your bar, and you know when your friends come by, you're going to let it sit for about a month, so you're not going to be able to drink it right away. So put it in a pretty container, and you can have it sitting out, and every time you walk by, you're going to want to taste it, but you're going to wait because it's all about the anticipation.
Letting it simmer?
Yeah. So I've washed the blackberries. I'm putting them in the decanter. And we're going to add 1 cup of simple syrup. We're using it plain, and we just poured it over the blackberries. And then you're going to choose a white liquor. So in this case, we have Indiana vodka here.
So you just want something that's sort of like a blank slate, clear?
Exactly. Okay, and we're going to add about 3 cups of vodka. And then I'm going to add a little bit of Chambord. And this is just going to give us a little extra kick of the raspberry flavor, so you can smell that. It's got a really nice perfume. Okay.
Now you got your pestle.
This is a pestle, or in the bar they call it a muddler. And we're just going to take this and stamp down the blackberries a little bit. That's just going to help them start to macerate quicker and give off their color. But you can see that it's a very pale purple now.
But compared to these other drinks that you made, it's going to turn really vibrant purple and red.
It'll be very, very dark. And I've got, like I said, I've got some of this for you to try. This is the one that I made about 3 weeks ago. So I'm just going to give you a little taste of that.
Oh, that is the reddest of red. Cheers.
Santé bonheur means health and good times.
Woo!
It's got a kick.
I'm going to have another sip. This is also really great to spoon over ice cream for an adult dessert. Find the recipes for both of these drinks on our website, eartheats.org. And let us know what's in your glass right now. Send us comments, recipes, pictures to eartheats@gmail.com. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Ali Sohrabi, and the teams at Harvest Public Media and Traditional Arts Indiana. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for joining the fun today. Get yourself some good local eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.